Welcome back to another episode of Draws in Spanish, a podcast that showcases the creative journey of notable Latinx visual artists and designers. I'm your host, Fabiola Lara. Thank you so much for being here with me today. Thank you for clicking play. Before I introduce today's guest, I wanted to first thank all of you who have written reviews for the podcast so far. It's truly like the most meaningful way to support the show. So really big thank you. I also want to thank all of those who have shared episodes with friends, who have shared about the episodes in your stories, who have DM'd me about episodes. And thank you for generally being excited about this. I have to say that because I've had this idea for this podcast for a while, and it's a lot of work. Honestly, it's work that I enjoy, but it's work nonetheless. And your positive feedback, it really keeps me going. It means the world to me. I don't know how to express that to you, but just know it really means a lot to me. So I wanted to say thank you. I'd love to hear more from you so it doesn't feel like I'm just releasing episodes into the void. Please reach out to me on Instagram or YouTube or literally wherever and just like tell me if you like it, what you don't like about it, anything, just reach out. Let me know if you want to connect about something. I am here. And if you've listened to a few episodes already, please consider writing a review, since that's the biggest way to support the show. Anyway, I just wanted to like take a moment to thank you guys for your enthusiasm and for sharing the show and for just supporting me. Basically, thank you for supporting me. Okay, let's get back to the show now. Today, I'm so honored to chat with Houston-based artist and YouTuber Paloma Cordova, aka Paloma the Peach. Paloma is a Mexican illustrator who runs her own online shop, YouTube channel, and Patreon, and even recently collaborated with Kinokuniya USA on a set of stickers. She creates really warm and playful characters, drawing inspiration from everyday life and her two cute cats, Salem and Clementine. All right, let's get into this chat with Paloma. You are not going to want to miss this. We talk about so much. I had an incredible conversation with her. Hey, Paloma, welcome to Draws in Spanish. I am so excited that you agreed to be on the show. I have been watching your videos for a really long time now, so this is like an honor to me. I'm just so excited to chat with you about your work and about you being Mexican and everything that that involves. But before we get started into all the fun stuff, could you introduce yourself for those who might not know who you are or aren't familiar with your work?
Hello, everyone. My name is Paloma. My artist name is Paloma the Peach. On Instagram, I have Paloma el Duraznito, just because I think that's a cute thing. And I am currently an art student, an artist on my journey. I make YouTube videos of behind the scenes of my art and the work that I do. I run a Patreon, and I am just figuring things out and selling my art merch.
Yay! Yes, that's awesome. Thank you so much for that. I'm sure most people will be familiar with you already, but just in case. Okay, so just right off the bat, I know that you're Mexican. You've mentioned that like everywhere, but can you tell me where you were born and where you were raised?
So I was born in Guadalajara, Jalisco, and I moved with my parents when I was about 1 year old, so I don't remember. And we lived in California until I was about 3 years old, and I have been living in Houston, Texas ever since.
Nice. Awesome. I was born in Chile, and I moved here when I was a baby, so I have like no recollection. So that's awesome. And so now you've been in Texas for a long time now.
Yes, I have lived in Houston, Texas for 17 years now.
Then my next question was, how many generations has your family been in the U.S.? But this would be...
Yes. So I guess I would be immigrant generation. The first person in my family to move to the U.S. was one of my aunts, and she moved to the U.S. in the 90s. But we moved here in about 2001. So basically immigrant generation.
Immigrant zero. I like to call that zero. But I don't know how you feel about that. Because for me, technically, you know, I was born in Chile, so I'm also the zero generation, right? The first start. But I've been here all of my life and I feel really assimilated, right? Because I grew up here. So I like to call myself like half generation, not quite first. I don't know about you, but sometimes I feel like it's unfair to consider myself zero generation since like it's not like the same as my parents' experience, right? Like their experience is different than mine. I don't know how you feel about that.
I still would consider myself the zero generation just because my parents, you know, we moved here at the same time. And even though I was a baby, growing up as a child, I still felt like I went through the same struggles that my parents went through. So struggling to learn English, I went to school not knowing English. Growing up having parents with accents was like a really big marker for my childhood, you know, compared to other kids' parents, especially in Texas in the South. You very much stick out a lot if you're an immigrant. So I feel like my experience is quite similar to my parents because it kind of felt like we were roommates.
I get that totally. For me, I have a lot of similarities and I rarely meet people that, I don't know about you, but like I live right now in Philadelphia. I don't have that many like Latinx, Latino immigrant friends almost, you know? So I'm like, oh yeah, me too. But I also didn't, you know, I had to go to ESOL for like 3 years when I was in elementary school or whatever. But I guess I had the luck of growing up in Miami at first. And so everybody around us was from a Hispanic country, from Latin America. So it was kind of like normal in a sense for your parents to either speak Spanish or have an accent or whatever. It was pretty normal as opposed to what I'm hearing that you're saying. Tough. That's tough. It's already hard being like a immigrant kid and having like that dual life, you know, like where you go to school and you're like, I don't know if you're pretending to be American, but you're like trying to fit in.
No, yeah, definitely trying to be as American as possible.
Yeah, that's tough. Given that you live in Texas, which is proximity-wise really close to Mexico, what's your current relationship with your Mexican heritage, with your roots?
So I have never announced this, but I feel comfortable saying it in this podcast. I am undocumented. I am under the DACA program. So I unfortunately have never been able to go visit Mexico. Technically, now we're allowed to get permits to travel outside of the country. I just don't feel comfortable. So my family that lives in Mexico, they will come visit. It's usually been every year, but since the pandemic, they haven't really come to visit. It's only been my grandparents so that they could come and get their vaccine because in Mexico, the vaccine thing is a whole mess.
Thank you so much for sharing that. First off, I grew up undocumented until I was 15. I just had the, oh, I get emotional. I had the like luck of my, sorry. I had the luck of my mom getting married to an American citizen before I turned 18. So it was just a pure, you know, I mean, my mom fully knowing like it's better for her to do this now than later. But otherwise I would have been under, at the time when I got my green card, the DACA program was just a concept. Obama was talking about it, but it hadn't been passed or anything. So I'm so glad to hear that you are under that program, even though it's not perfect, it's better than nothing. I'm just glad to be able to talk to people about it because I think it's a really big part of being Latino in the US is your immigration status. And you either are really aware of it or you're just oblivious to it.
Yeah. And it's honestly terrifying to talk about because you don't know if you're putting yourself in danger or your family. And there's also a lot of Latinos that are against illegal immigration. Like they do not like you if you are undocumented.
I know. And that's really unfortunate because I think people fail to realize that there's not legal ways to come here that really makes sense for most people who are trying to come here. Like if you can afford to come here just for fun because you want to switch it up, not because you want to switch it up, but you want, you know, American opportunities or whatever, then there's a pathway maybe for you that if you can afford it. But most people who need to come here seeking a better life can't afford the pathways that are currently available. And it's really frustrating for people to not recognize that. But I also think a lot of Americans just don't even know what the options are. They're like, why don't you just come here legally? And it's like, name one way. And there's none. And I feel like for DACA and for Dreamers, it's really tough because you can be on that program for a really long time with almost no kind of relief. And you've been here since you were one. So it's like so unfair. So what's your relationship with your Mexican heritage, given that you're so close to Mexico? Now knowing that you don't have the liberty, it's not really the most comfortable thing to be traveling across the border when you don't have a green card or like, even if you have it, it's always dicey. Like when I had a green card, I barely traveled because I was like, I don't want to deal with this. So how do you kind of stay in touch with your Mexican heritage anyway?
So my boyfriend, we started dating over a year ago, and he's also a Mexican immigrant. And I didn't realize how amazing it is to date someone within your nationality and even like immigration status, because I've never done that before. I've always dated outside of my race, my nationality. And once I started dating him, it really caused me and my relationship with my Mexican heritage to really flourish because he has the same experiences. And even though he's from Monterrey, which is a different area, it's, you know, still somewhat the same heritage. His family, I understand, he understands my family. So it's been really good to be with him. That has definitely helped me feel a lot more connected to my Mexican heritage. I speak Spanish with my entire family, so that obviously keeps me connected. I eat a lot of Mexican food. I keep up with Mexican artists. I learn about Mexican art history. You know, I'm studying art history in university right now, and I'm thinking about specializing in Mexican art. So those are just some of the ways that I keep connected.
Oh, that's so cool. I mean, I'm so glad that you're dating someone with a similar background to you because, yeah, it just makes the whole thing, you feel less like alone. But being that you're in Texas, do you feel like you have a big community, you personally, of like other Mexican artists or just friends?
Growing up, not really. I have grown up in the suburbs of Houston, and that constitutes mostly white people. In elementary school, it was pretty varied, but moving into middle school and high school, it was really mostly white people or black people. There was not a lot of Hispanic people, and if there was, they weren't of immigration status. And that's something that I like to talk about a lot with people, that there's definitely at least a little bit of a barrier or a difference in identity when it comes to Mexican Americans and Mexicans who come from a different immigration status, if that makes sense. So no, I really did not grow up with people that I could relate to at all.
I wouldn't have thought that, given that maybe I am just ignorant on like Texas dynamics. I feel like maybe it's just like the news or just what you see everywhere, like that there's a really big Mexican population in Texas. And I like you're saying that may be true, but with the different generations, I definitely like get that because it's a totally different experience if you grow up never thinking about immigration status as opposed to it being kind of like a daily issue.
Yeah. And there is definitely a lot of Mexicans in Texas, but I would say it's a lot more concentrated in San Antonio and in El Paso. I mean, Houston, it just got named the most diverse city in the country. So we are a mixing pot of a lot of different cultures. But, you know, where my boyfriend lives, he lives on the east side of Houston, and there is a much larger population of Mexicans over there and just Hispanics in general. But just the area that I grew up in, there wasn't a lot.
Just hasn't been your experience. Yeah, I get that. I grew up in Miami, like I was telling you. And so there it's like super Latino heavy. And then I moved in middle school north 2 hours. And it was like just blue eyes and blonde hair, like surfing white people, a side of Florida that I had like never in my entire life seen. And it was completely different. And that was just like, yeah, like you're saying, it really varies depending on what part of the state you live in. Can just completely change your whole experience. Well, that's unfortunate. I'm sorry to hear that you felt a little bit disconnected, but at least you have your family. Now you have your boyfriend. That's always cool. I've never dated anyone with the same immigration status as me. I mean, now that I'm a citizen recently, but before that, it was always kind of like this thing I carried in my back pocket. And you just like figure out when to disclose it.
Yeah, because a lot of people have the stereotype of like, oh, you want to marry me for a visa or a green card. So it is a little bit scary to break it to someone that you're dating for the first time.
I like to think that now people are more open-minded about it, or they kind of want to know more. But I really feel like for the vast majority of Americans, it's not something that they ever have to think about. And they never think about the status of other people. So it's like really feels like a bomb that you're dropping when you first bring this up in any way. How was it like growing up undocumented for you? I know that you still are, but you have your DACA status. So how was that like in your experience? I'm just curious because I never really had the chance to talk about it with anyone.
So I didn't know that I was undocumented until I was about 14 years old, which I think was a good decision on my parents' part. I really think it would have affected me a lot mentally as a kid. You know, that's a lot to think about, your parents possibly disappearing and, you know, you having to be taken away. So luckily they kept it from me and they protected me from it. But there were a lot of things that wouldn't make sense to me. Like licenses, driving licenses. A lot of people, like you said, they're very ignorant when it comes to stuff like this just because they have never been able to be connected with it. So they don't really know. But, you know, stuff like driver's license, bank accounts, buying a house or renting an apartment, all that stuff was always very difficult for my parents. And I didn't know why, but now I know why. But once it hit me, I really did have a lot of anxiety for a very long time. Now it's kind of like a feeling that I've become numb to, and it's something that's pretty out of my control. So I can't sit down and think about how my parents could be taken away or my DACA could be taken away. But yeah, luckily my parents protected me and they explained to me the DACA, and I think I got it when I was about 16, 17. And, you know, I'm under protection and I try to protect my parents as much as I can.
That's good. I'm so glad you have that program. And I think it's important for people to realize how much it means to people. Because I think it's immigration is one of those issues that unless you've had to think about it before, you literally have no reason to think about it. And so I love that we can talk about this. How was it like when your parents first told you, processing that?
I don't remember an exact moment where they told me, but I remember when I got my DACA and then my Social Security card came in probably a year later or so. And my dad just starts crying. And, you know, dads, especially Mexican dads, they don't cry. So he just starts crying. And, you know, he's telling me this is so big for you because, you know, obviously they don't have Social Security cards. And I think that's the moment that it really hit me how serious all of this was and how my status and my parents' status had affected us while I was growing up and how it was going to affect me becoming an adult, because it has, you know, getting this apartment was very difficult, being undocumented, no rental history, no credit history, anything, very difficult to get apartments. I experienced a lot of discrimination when I was applying to apartments.
It affects everything you do constantly. I can't even imagine. I don't know if it's good or bad, but like I found out since I was a kid, like since I have consciousness, I knew that I was undocumented, but I remember little things like, you know, it's hard to explain to like a 7-year-old what immigration is. So I remember like asking my mom like trick questions, you know, like, okay, mom, what about like, why can't we travel? Or like, why can't I go there? Okay, but what if I was born here? Then that would change everything. Like, how does that matter? Like just as a kid being like, why does it matter if I was born here or there? And her trying to explain it to me. And it's definitely almost better not to know, but it's still hard. Then once you know, it's like helpless too, you know, like what's better? It's tough. I hope that they make something, that something changes, you know?
Yeah, right now my siblings are citizens because they were born here. I have two younger siblings, but so it's just me and my parents. But, you know, the pressure is really laid on thick for me to get married because that right now seems like it's going to be the only way because there doesn't seem like there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
I hate to say it, but I would agree with your parents. I've seen it happen and I feel like that's the only foolproof way because otherwise every other option is not guaranteed. So it's like, and expensive. So like if it happens to be that you meet someone, you fall in love, hey, maybe it's not a bad idea to get married, but it's tough. I can't imagine. My family, I feel like, had a different experience than your family because if you moved here in the early 2000s, I think it was different. My parents moved here in the early 90s and you could get a social security number. My parents came from Chile on a flight. And so they had to get social security number state approved for visas and stuff like that. So they had all that stuff. And before basically pre-9/11, you could get like a driver's license. And that lasted for a while. And then after 9/11, it's like horrible.
Yeah. My parents were actually able to get Texas driver's license when we first moved here. But by the time that they expired, they took that away in Texas.
Yeah. I remember my family like traveling around the U.S. to try and get it. But again, that's risky and it's in and of itself, you know, like we drove out of Florida to try to get a driver's license in Georgia. And that drive alone is 12 hours, craziest 12 hours. You know, I was like, I think I was 12. And I remember being like, if we get pulled over, we're done for. But, you know, it is what it is. We did not get anything on that trip. It was the first time I left the state. So that was kind of interesting. Okay. Speaking about immigration and the relationship, your Mexican heritage here in the U.S. and how that impacts your everyday life. Are there any Mexican stereotypes that you are most sick of? I ask this because I want to, like, hopefully anyone listening can learn a little bit.
So I think the first one is, and I want to preface this by saying that I know that I'm lighter skinned for a Mexican woman. I do definitely benefit from lighter skinned privilege. And whenever I would share my nationality with people, they would be very shocked and be like, oh, I thought you were Middle Eastern. I thought you were some sort of Asian, et cetera. So I guess in the back of my mind, I always wonder what people are picturing in their head when they think of a Mexican woman. And I can't help but imagine that they are thinking of a face that is very stereotypical. So I think that's the main thing that I have experienced just growing up in general.
No, yeah, that's a big one. I feel like Americans, I guess by what I mean by Americans is like white people in the U.S. But even, I guess they can be from any race or whatever, have like this very specific idea of what a Mexican person and or like a Latino person looks like. I'm not Mexican, but I feel like I've gotten that. People are shocked, you know, that I'm from Chile because I think people just think all of Latin America is just like one place. And they have like a stereotype for that.
To me, I look at you and I'm like, oh yeah, she's from Chile. And I think it's because I'm Hispanic and I know all the countries in Latin America and I know people from different countries. So I look at you and I'm like, yeah, she's from Chile.
That's amazing. I've never thought that about myself, looking at myself, because I have never met that many Chilean people, persons being here. So thank you. But I feel like I get what you're saying. It's tough because you're like, well, what did you expect? What were you expecting exactly? If you have another one, you can mention it. I don't know if you...
I mean, I feel like the other ones are probably ones that we hear a lot because I think Mexican stereotypes, they're still pretty normalized and socially acceptable in comparison to stereotypes about other races. So the whole Mexicans mow lawns, do landscaping, do hard labor. Yes, a lot of us do. But again, the reason that we do is because we're undocumented and we can't get a job anywhere else. That's why we do it.
It's so unfair because it's like a catch-22. It's like, okay, you don't want Mexican people to do that, then what else would you like Mexican people to do for you? Like, what do you mean? And also how? It's because you people who think that, who are so small-minded, don't realize like the context of it all. Like, oh, these are the jobs that they can get because of their immigration status. These are the jobs that people don't ask questions about. Recently talking on your Instagram stories, you mentioned a few times considering yourself white passing and kind of digesting that and figuring navigating that. Like, where are you with that topic? Speaking of races within your nationality, how do you feel about that? And how did you come to terms with that or navigate that?
Well, I took an anthropology course, I think maybe last semester or the semester before. And that is where I learned that we are racialized. There is no actual like divided human races. We're just racialized because of stuff, history and everything. And so I guess on technical terms, if someone were to ask me, what is your race? I would say I'm white and Native American, but that's what most Mexicans are. You know, we're a mixture of the people that colonized us and the indigenous people that were already living on Mexican land. So I used to think that I was white passing because, and I'm going to be honest, TikTok gaslit me into thinking that's what I was, because I have tended to navigate the world in a very walking on eggshells way, in the sense that I am terrified of making people upset and offending people. Just in general, I have a very bad phobia of making people mad. So me trying to like stand back and not offend people, I would be like, yeah, I'm white passing. But then I learned also on TikTok, this woman, she was like, I never thought that this term would be so popularized, but white passing just means that if you walk into a country club with a bunch of blonde, blue-eyed people and you can go undetected, then that means that you're white passing. And I personally feel like that's not the case for me. I have suffered a lot of dysphoria about people commenting on my appearance in every sense of like my body and what I look like ethnically and stuff like that. So I have kind of like drawn the line and that I won't allow people to try to tell me what I am. But again, I do recognize the privilege that comes with being lighter skinned. So I do try to be more self-aware, and, you know, I'm still navigating it. But right now it's kind of like I am a light-skinned Mexican because I have taken my ancestry test, which actually someone informed me that those aren't even really that accurate. But I am about 60% European, 40% indigenous.
It's tough. It's so tough. I mean, I have a hard time thinking about it too, because I don't want to upset anyone. But I see what you're saying, like that you don't necessarily feel like you could get away with being white, quote, quote, if you were in these white spaces. And that may be true. It just really depends on the scenario. But for me, I lived ever so briefly in Barcelona. I went to a illustration postgrad program there. And that's when I realized that these people accept me as white, but they also discriminate against me for being South American. So that's just like its own Spanish problem. But I realized like I fit in racially with everyone here. I worked in corporate America for a while and I felt like I fit in. I felt like unless I told someone, well, my name is a dead giveaway. That benefit of the doubt is such a big benefit, but it's still not like the ultimate getaway card, especially when you consider your immigration status. When you have all these things at play, it really like leaves you with no good label.
I mean, I think it's a conversation that we have a lot in the Latina community. And it's not like we don't want to be white, right? It's not like, oh no, I don't want to identify as white. I kind of just want to like get it right, if that makes sense. And not in an egocentric way where it's like, I always want to be right. In the sense of like, I don't want to offend anyone.
And I want to know.
Yeah. And I want to make sure I'm checking my privilege. Basically getting it right. But I think maybe this goes for you as well. It would be weird for me to just be like, yeah, I'm white.
I actually was going to say I'm white. I identify racially as white because I think if you take off all these situations, if I look at it like point blank, I think racially, I am just as white as the Italian down the street here in Philly. It's all these other characteristics that then influence that I'm Latina. I think the problem, in my opinion, comes with like in the US, people think that white means colonial white. And I think that's where it's like broken down. I think we have like the idea of race kind of mixed up in the US. And people think that white people are only like this type of white people.
I mean, when I put down my race on papers, like for tests and stuff, I just put down white because I don't know what else. That's a whole other thing that came with Mexican citizens in the US and whatnot. But anyways, the reason that I don't feel comfortable just being like, I'm white like you are, is because I know that I have indigenous roots. That's the only thing that stops me, is I also don't want to contribute to erasure of indigenous roots, but I also don't want to be like, no, I'm not white. Definitely in America, identifying as a race is not just like a racial thing. It definitely comes with like a cultural connotation.
Exactly. And I wouldn't identify with that.
I also don't identify as brown. I'm definitely not a brown person. I had someone be like, well, you're not brown. And I was like, yeah, I'm not.
I feel that. I'm glad that we can both clarify that. We're just proving to each other that we're not people of color, but we are Latinos.
I've had people call me a person of color, but again, that just contributes to my dysphoria because I have some people be like, yes, person of color, queen. And I'm just like, that doesn't feel right. But then when people are like, yeah, you're white, I'm like,
that doesn't feel right either. I know. Both terms don't feel right. To me, like I feel comfortable calling myself white, but with my understanding of it. But if I were to go to like just a general place, it would be hard for me to be like, I'm white to like some random person. Cause I know they would be like, no, you're not, you know? So there's like so many nuances, and I'm so glad we get to talk about it, even though maybe we've bored some people, because it's so hard here in the US. And I think like, it's only something that you experience, I think, in the US. In Latin America, they'd be like, no, you're just this, move on. But it's not so simple because you have all these other things. You have your immigration status, you have your race, you have your ethnicity, you have your culture, you have your Native American roots. It's just like, there's no clear answer. And I think that's why every TikTok that you see, you're like, no, it's not quite right. Moving away from the complexity of your identity, how did you get into art and illustration? And like, now that you're studying, is your major art history?
I finished my associate's degree at community college in fine arts. So I did all the studio classes. I did ceramics, sculpture, design, all that fun stuff was in my associate's degree. And I transferred to University of Houston. So there is no illustration major at any university in Texas at all. And again, because I'm undocumented, and I hate bringing it up so much, but it literally affects every aspect. Because I'm undocumented, I pay out of state tuition in Texas because I'm not a citizen or whatever. But if I were to go out of Texas, I would be counted as an international student. So I would have to pay international tuition, which is insane. So leaving the state was not an option for me.
I am rolling my eyes so hard because that is so ridiculous. And I have to mention it for listeners so they don't think I'm just sitting here smiling. But anyways, okay, so you have to stay in Texas, but they don't offer illustration programs.
So U of H, closest university to me, they do have an arts program, but I kind of got sick of doing the studio arts thing. I really wanted to do illustration because that is something that I've never learned in like a professional or educational setting, but that's not an option. And I didn't want to go the fine arts route again because I was like, I cannot take 2 to 3 more years of this because it's a lot of work. So I am majoring in art history and minoring probably in studio arts just because I have all the credits for it, but I might minor in French. So yeah, I've been doing art since I was a child. I think everyone did art as a kid because it's very encouraged when you're a kid, but I continued it throughout my entire life. As a child, I always did this thing in Texas. It might be only in Houston. It's called like the Rodeo Art Fair or whatever. And we have a rodeo every year in Houston, and it's where a bunch of people gather and there's like carnival concerts and stuff like that. But there's also a section for like super rich people to go and buy things. So they buy like livestock, like super, super expensive livestock and art. So they will buy your art for like thousands or tens of thousands of dollars, which is insane.
That's blowing my mind. You can do both of those things in one place.
Yeah, it's huge. When we didn't have it, when the pandemic hit, it was like a huge financial loss for the city. So growing up, I did all the rodeo art things and stuff like that throughout school. But it was always kind of like a thing that someone labeled onto me. So I was like, okay, I'm sticking with it. And then when I hit my last years of high school, when it was time to get serious about school, I was kind of exploring different ideas. I was like, I should do something seen as more practical, quote unquote, something seen as more lucrative financially. So I considered other routes. And that's also partially why I went to community college, because by the time I graduated, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I started taking art pretty seriously my first year of college because I started as a fashion design major. And as a fashion design major, you had to take studio classes as well. And when I took my first studio class, I was like, this is it. I'm good at this. This is what I love. So that's when I started taking it like super seriously.
But then you kind of fell off the fashion path?
Yeah, I switched my major to studio arts.
Perfect. Yeah, you were like, let's leave the fashion. Let's just do the art. I totally get the pressure of following like a more lucrative, quote unquote, career. I went to school, I changed my major a million times, but I went to school for, I was really set that I wanted to be a scientist. And then I realized I don't want to do this anymore. I was like, I don't want to actually be a scientist. Like I like science, but I don't want to actively make science happen. And I switched a lot. And it's because I had that pressure being an immigrant, being like, okay, if I have this opportunity, I'm not going to like, quote, blow it on art. Even though my family is very supportive, they're also like, money. How does your family feel about you pursuing a more creative career?
A little bit of backstory. When I graduated high school, I was extremely depressed, extremely anxious. I was going through the worst anxious and panic attack era of my entire life. So all I would do was like lay in bed. I would literally do nothing but lay in bed. So my parents were just very like, do something. I was kind of like, I want to do fashion design. And they were like, okay. And I think because I was going through that such severe mental health crisis that they didn't want to
discourage anything.
Yeah. They weren't like super like, yeah, do it. But they were just like, okay, it's a direction you can go in. Cool. And then I started doing the art thing. And I feel like when you tell people that you are either majoring in art or you're an artist, they think about the fine art world, where it's like, you want to be so rich because you want to be selling your $1 million paintings to the art market, blah, blah, blah. People tend to reduce the art world to that. So my parents were, they had that perspective. They were like, okay, well, you need to make it in the fine art world.
They're like, we want to see you at the MoMA. Go.
Yeah. That's also what professors push on you when you're a fine art or studio arts major. They're like, you're not going to wow the curators with this one and stuff like that. And then after a few years of doing that, I was like, I don't care about that. I don't care about wowing rich people.
I think that's a breakthrough that a lot of people have. They're like, wait a minute. Do I have to go that way to fine art? Like, is that the only way right now?
So they were kind of looking at it from that perspective and they were like, yeah, do it. So the whole illustration thing came from my love of stickers and cute stationery. So it's not like I was like, I want to be an illustrator. I was like, there is not enough stickers for me that I love. So I'm going to make ones that I think are cute and I can sell them. And my parents were like, yeah, that's cute. Sure.
And they're just like, why not? Go for it. They're like, we like your entrepreneurial spirit.
Yes, because both my parents are entrepreneurs. So they're like, yeah, do it. So my parents being excited that I was not depressed anymore and wanted to do something with my life, my dad bought me a little Cricut machine because I had no money.
Oh my God, I love that so much. It makes my heart so warm.
Yeah, that is one thing. We can get into the whole toxicity of Hispanic parents and their so much trauma. But the one thing that my parents really got right is like, if I was like, I want to do this, they were like, yes. Like, we want to help you. So my dad bought me the cutting machine and some sticker paper. And I was like, okay, I'm going to give it a try. And I actually opened the store in like mid-2019, I think. And I think throughout the whole, like in 1 year, I only had like 30 sales. But I was fine with it. I was like, I'm having fun making these stickers. And my parents kind of saw it as like this like silly little hobby. It was like, yeah, it makes her happy. It's a cute little thing that she does, but I don't think that's really your career. And I was like, yeah, maybe not. But then it started taking off. And I think this reigns true for not only parents, but just like other people in our lives. Once something starts becoming financially lucrative, everyone is like, yeah, that's valid.
I agree with that, but it's not surprising. It's annoying that it has to be proven that way, but hey, at least you proved it.
I started doing that. And I think the first two illustrators or artists that I discovered were Catnip Illustrations and Apple Cheeks. I think they are like probably some of the biggest or most iconic illustrators in the community, and especially on YouTube. So I discovered everything through YouTube, and I kind of saw the possibility of what this stuff could become. I was like, wow, I didn't know that people did this. And then, you know, I followed them on Instagram, and then I saw who they would follow or they would post on their stories and stuff. And I was like, this is a whole community.
Yeah, these people are doing something. I love that because I feel the same way. And so did they inspire you to start your YouTube channel, or when did that kind of also click with the sticker making?
Well, I've been doing YouTube since I was like 15. So I have always had my YouTube channel. There were many times in my youth that I just wanted to delete it because it's not like I was posting consistently for like 5 years. I would post a few videos and then disappear for like a year and then do the same thing over and over. I think it was 2018 or maybe 2019. I started doing stationery videos, stationery hauls, kind of like Amanda Rach Lee. She's probably like the biggest bullet journaling YouTuber. So it's kind of like that vibe, like really into the mixture of arts and crafts sort of thing. So I started making videos about that, and that kind of like drew in a lot of people. But like I said, I was a child, and I'm not going to lie, that shit messed me up bad. But 2018, 2019 is when I really started drawing people in with like the stationery stuff, bullet journaling stuff. That was also a period in my life where I was very depressed. Stationery and all that cute stuff really helped me with all of that. It was like a nice distraction. And then that led me again into Apple Cheeks kind of illustrations. And then they inspired me to start making videos, like studio vlogs and stuff.
I love it. I can see exactly what you're saying. I'm so glad that you took kind of like that little bit of interest and like cultivated it with YouTube along the way. And now you have like this full-fledged business, with your shop and your Patreon and your channel. So now that you have your channel and that you've kind of redirected it from fashion to art, which is where you are today, how did you kind of get started with your Patreon? Like, and how do you feel about your career now?
So I started my Patreon, again, seeing other people doing it. I think the first person that I saw or that I explored their Patreon page was Cheyenne Barton. She's also kind of like an OG illustrator. And I kind of was just like, I think it's time. I think I'm able to do a Patreon page now. I think I've been doing art long enough on the internet to kind of announce this to people. And leading up to it and preparing it, every day I would like call my boyfriend and be like, I don't think anyone's going to sign up. Like, I was convinced. And I was like, this is going to be really embarrassing. And if I'm like, hey guys, I made this thing. And then, because the amount of patrons that you have is public and it's just like the number is zero. And so I was like, that's going to be really embarrassing. And I was fully convinced, like, I thought it was so insane that anyone would sign up for my Patreon. And he was like, that's not true. You know, that's not true. And I was like, no, I don't. I started it, I think, February of 2021. So yeah, I just started it because I saw other people were doing it and it seemed like a really good way to create stable income as an artist, because you can't, it's very scary to depend on just store sales because it varies and fluctuates so much. And I was considering like moving out because I knew I was transferring to university. I needed to live closer to the city. And I was like, I either need to find a regular job or I really need to hone in on this one, because if I find a regular job with school and the job, I won't have time to do the whole illustration thing. So I wanted to kind of make it into a more stable career.
And you did, because people signed up. Okay. Your fears never happened. People signed up. I'm so happy for you. And what would be like your piece of advice for someone who's considering a Patreon? Because I feel like I approached the illustration kind of path in a different way, in the sense that I never thought about a shop. I always thought about it in terms of getting clients. So what would be your advice for someone who wants to do that now? Because I hope to one day be able to do that, but I feel like you need to kind of get all your ducks in a row.
Yeah. So Patreon, really the whole package, Patreon, Instagram, YouTube, all of that is content creating, whether we like it or not. Yes, first, we're an artist, but we're still content creators. Like, anything that you create for the internet is content that you made. So I think establishing that kind of content creator side to yourself is going to be the best way to do it. And then being consistent with it, because that's how you build people that enjoy your art. Because that's the basis of having a Patreon, is people really enjoy your art and they want to see more than what like the general public gets to see. So being consistent and working hard to make that like content creator label for yourself will, I think, be the first step to making a Patreon. Because like I said, you don't want to like make one and like have everything ready and then no one signs up and you're like, man.
Oh, that hurts. I know. I feel like anything that you do nowadays, if no one signs up, if no one likes or comments it, it's just so embarrassing. But it's also like the reality, you know? That's how it is. People have to start at some point, you know? But really good advice. I feel like nowadays a lot of artists, it's like super polarizing. I talked about this on an episode with Fran Nerd. Incredible. We love her here on Draws in Spanish. But she was mentioning that she also considers herself a content creator. And I think a lot of artists don't. Like, they hate that term. But I'm also like, you guys, are you watching what's happening? Like, I think we should hop on this. Like, I think we should all like go for it. And it's really polarizing. So I'm glad to hear that you're like pro content creation. So I think it's just a term that people don't like, but it's also like a reality of being an artist now.
I don't want to be a content creator my whole life. I'm very grateful for it, extremely grateful. And it still shocks me to this day that it's a thing. But it's definitely extremely tolling on the mind and the body. So if the opportunity to be more client-based or, you know, graduate with my art history degree and work in the art history field came up, I think I would move towards that. I would probably combine the two just so not as much pressure is on content creating.
That makes a lot of sense and is smart, but I like that you're keeping it open because it's ever evolving. Like, I feel like this is the first generation where content creators are like growing with it. You haven't seen that, right? Like, we don't know what like a 40-year-old content creator looks like. I'm going to keep that in mind personally for myself. The advice. I just started a YouTube channel this year or last year. I don't really know.
Oh, yay.
And it's so embarrassing. Like I said, like starting from zero is rough because I felt like I feel like I've been online my entire life, but YouTube is the one thing that I never touched. Like I watched, but I never touched. I never participated. So I started YouTube from scratch. It's been fun though. But I think it's been fun because like I know who I am at this point. I'm not as like easily influenced as like when I was a teenager.
Yeah. Now I have fun with it. Now I pretty much get to do it whenever I want. I don't feel pressure to like be a certain way or post all the time.
I feel like you make YouTube and everything that you do, like your Patreon, your shop, your client collaboration with Kinokuniya, you made everything look really like easy and chill and like it's flowing super, super naturally. Like how are you staying on top of it all and like balancing everything that you're doing?
I am not.
Okay, you're not. All right. That's the reality for everyone. Do you have like a schedule or things that you prioritize? Like any sort of routine happening?
So I say I'm not because I am back at school now. So the pandemic hit 2020. I was in community college still. You know, that semester was a whole mess. We got moved to online and then I did two semesters fully online. So this is my first semester completely in school while this career is going on. So I am learning to navigate it. It's extremely difficult. All of these things are things that have to come from your own will and motivation. None of this is like clocking into a job or, you know, very like structured stuff. All of this is like, okay, I got to get up and do it now. So I have this planner that I just bought at like Walmart because I was trying to do the cute little planning thing with all the, I can't. So I just got a random planner and I write down, I plan out my week every week. And on the monthly calendar, I write down like the super important deadlines, like for my Patreon or for school if I have a test or something. I think the only downside is probably that I just recently realized that I don't enjoy life. Like I don't do anything for my enjoyment. So I've been trying to also in my planner, like schedule in moments to watch something, to play a video game, to hang out with someone, because I will forget about people. I will stay at my little desk and do stuff. And then I'll be like, oh, I haven't seen my friends in 3 months.
A few weeks ago, you posted on Instagram that you were questioning whether your art was worth sharing to the world or if it carried value. I have to say, I think about that constantly. Literally every other week, I'm like having a crisis about if it's valuable and why. What made you think of that? What made you kind of spiral into that moment?
I wish that you didn't have to go through that, but I'm also glad that I'm not alone because it definitely is a very isolating feeling. I think what makes me feel that way is I look at all the other art that is saturating the market and I'm like, is there even a space for me to like push something new, right? And I don't think that we as artists have to create something completely and entirely unique because that doesn't exist anymore. That's why in the fine art world, there's so much more performance art and like those insane pieces that like you look at and you're like, what even is that? So we're all inspired by something, but I get in very depressive moods. And I think especially again, touching on the phobia of making people upset and wanting to do the right thing. I do have OCD. I will disclose that. So I'm not just saying this as like, oh, I have OCD because, you know, people don't actually, and they use it as like a quirky term. I actually do have OCD and I have really bad moral OCD. So I am constantly twisting and turning these ideas and these thoughts in my mind. And I'm like, am I contributing something to the collective? Like I'm thinking of it as like this really intense big picture. And I'm like,
that's a lot of pressure to put on yourself.
Yeah. So I do get into these moods where I'm like, am I even contributing something? making something new enough, or am I just making art that people can be like, oh, that looks like that person's art? And then I kind of get out of it and I'm like, well, it's not really my job to be like the next big innovative illustrator. So the thing that helps me is I will go through periods of time where I will not scroll through my Instagram feed because I like following artists. I like being inspired by artists. I like supporting my art friends, liking their posts, commenting on it, posting it on my story. But I really try not to scroll through my feed. So that way I know that my subconscious is not pulling stuff that I was scrolled by, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You're like, I don't want to feed the little subconscious beast in there.
So I try to limit my inspiration from other people's art. I used to do that a lot more when I first started, which makes sense. I had never done illustration or digital drawing before. So it makes sense that you look more to what other people are doing. But now I don't do that as much. I try to find real life objects. My studio space is filled with little tiny objects that inspire me. And I can, when I look at it, I remember that same feeling. And it helps me come up with more, not even just like original, quote unquote original or unique stuff, but stuff that feels truly me, which will naturally come off as unique to people. They're like, oh yeah, this is a Paloma piece.
Right. Your influences are separate from what's being posted online. So you can trust that they are like your true influences.
Yes. So with that painting, I was like, I am just going to paint whatever picture is formed in my head. And it doesn't have to mean anything. And it doesn't have to come from anything. And it doesn't have to make sense. But I'm literally just going to do whatever.
It's really valuable now to get inspiration offline. I wonder if it has anything to do with your kind of degree, with you studying art history, if that's helping you also like diversify your influences.
Yes. So it helps me kind of see where things come from. So actually like talking about how I'm just letting the mind flow and the hand flow, you know, I had a class yesterday actually, because I'm taking a class called Critical Theory of Modern and Contemporary Art. And we were touching on surrealism and then kind of like this idea of atomism, which is basically where things don't have to make sense. You just do what your brain tells you to do. So it's kind of nice learning about all the different movements. It's kind of like rounding out your artistic experience and knowledge, which I think makes one's artistic style feel more complete and, again, more unique to you.
And differentiates your work from other people's work that's happening right now. I'm glad to see that you're like making a conscious effort to kind of get offline, get those influences from other places, not only for your OCD, if you have that, like you said, moral OCD, that has to influence it a lot as well. But even just as an artist, it's always good to diversify your influences, and you're inspiring me to like get offline a little bit. I mean, I've been doing like reading and stuff like that, but for me, it's like movies and TV really influence.
I buy a lot of art books. So like a lot of artists or illustrators, you know, they'll come out with a book that is literally just their art. It doesn't even have to have words. And I feel like that's also a really great way, because even though it's someone else's art, it's they intentionally put it into something, put it out there, and you're supporting them by giving them your money when you buy the book. And it's something physical to look at. So that's another thing that really helps.
I noticed that you redraw a lot of old illustrations, and I haven't seen too many people do that, because I feel like, I think just in this like Instagram world, we're always like a new thing. It has to be like completely new every time. And that's so nuts. And so I wanted to ask you like why you do that and why you like to give it like a second chance.
I'm fairly new to digital drawing. I have always done traditional media, painting and graphite, charcoal, whatever. And so I didn't start digital drawing until about 2019. And, you know, when I wanted to start designing my stickers and stuff. So I'm very new to it. And every few months I discover new techniques and I just improve my digital drawing, because you can be really good at drawing on regular paper and terrible at digital drawing. And I say that because that's how I was. I have a lot of ideas. I have insane amount of ideas and just like images that come into my head. A lot of times I feel like I don't have the skill to bring those to life. And so I like the ideas that I've done in the past, but I just kind of like going in and being like, well, I learned all these new techniques and this new way to color this. And I think it would look a lot better if I did it like this. And I have these new interests and I've grown as a person. So I just like going back and reworking it. And I think it's also because I'm pretty sure I'm the youngest illustrator, kind of like big illustrator online. I'm only 21 and I'm still not only figuring out who I am as an artist, but like as a person. I feel like you don't until you're like 30, 35. I change very rapidly and develop very rapidly, learn new things, new perspectives. So I think that goes for my art as well.
Yes, definitely. No, I think you're always like developing and it's cool. I love seeing when you like bring back an old piece and kind of reimagine it because yeah, you can kind of think like, oh, what would like the new Paloma do with this idea? And that's awesome. And I feel like for me, I'm just like so quick to abandon a piece. I'm like, okay, goodbye. See you never. And like moving on, I hate you. And so being like, oh, you know what? Let's give it a second chance is so sweet. And I really love that like, it feels like you give yourself kind of like the space to explore that. When I think right now, a lot of people are like, next, 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 don't look back. One more thing before we finish up, before we wrap up. I saw you recently collaborated with Kinokuniya USA. Huge congrats, major. Kinokuniya is awesome. When I lived in New York, I would go there semi-frequently. It's a bit out of the way, but I loved it. How did that come to be and how was it like to work on that?
The Kinokuniya here in Houston opened up about 2, maybe 3 years ago. I could be wrong. I don't fully remember. But when it opened up was when I was having like my sticker stationery moment. And all like the cute stationery stuff, that whole industry is very big in Japan. They make very high quality, very cute stuff. So when they opened up here, I had never heard of it before. And I was like, this is for me. This is amazing.
It's like almost like adult Sanrio or something. It's like a little bit more sophisticated.
I mean, it's a bookstore. For those of you who don't know, it's a bookstore, but they have a lot of really cute stationery. So that's why I go. So when they opened it up, I was like, this is my new home. And it was. I still go all the time. And I guess one of the employees, I wish I could remember their name, but I always say hi to them. But one of the employees was like, oh, are you Paloma? I love your videos. And I was like, oh, yeah. And I think that is when I was doing stationary videos. And I was like, oh, yeah. And she was like, oh, I love your videos. And I was like, oh, thank you. And we had this moment. And so then I was like, okay, well, one of the employees there knows who I am. And I guess it kind of like, I don't know if they all knew at the same time or if one of them was like just like talking to their coworker and was like, oh, my God, that's her, blah, blah, blah. And so I kind of got to know all of them and they all kind of started recognizing me every time I started coming in. And I'm not sure if this is the case at other Kinokuniya locations, but at the one in Houston, they do an art market every second and fourth Saturday of the month. And so they host a lot of artists. You submit an application and you can set up your little stall and sell there, and they announce it everywhere on their social media. And it's a huge turnout. A bunch of people come and it's a really fun time. So it's just the community of small artists with that specific Kinokuniya location is very large and small artists are very important to them. Basically, I went one day and I think I went up to one of the employees and I was like, oh, how do you apply to do the art market? Because I want to sell there. And then she was like, oh, I actually wanted to talk to you about a collaboration that we could do. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And they collaborate with a lot of artists. They take care of their artists very well. I loved working with them. And it was just a very chill thing. Like they were always like, no rush. We don't have any deadlines. You let us know when the artwork is ready. You send us all the paperwork, all that stuff.
That's awesome. I'm so glad to hear that. It seems like a genuine, natural partnership as opposed to like something completely random, but I feel like it's going to be only the beginning for like art collaborations and brand collaborations that you could do, Paloma. Seriously, I think I love that. That was like so much of what you mentioned was like in real life. I'm shocked because usually it's like some random email, you know, and you're saying like you genuinely got to know the people there. And yeah, it sounds like that Kinokuniya is really cool because I mean, they're all cool, but like I haven't seen that kind of engagement at other Kinokuniya locations, but really good for your first collaborate. What would be a dream collaboration for you so we can manifest it here right now?
Oh my goodness. I don't even know. I get such bad imposter syndrome when I think about doing client work and stuff like that. So that realm is still so crazy to me, but I would love to do some sort of collab with like a packaged food company, like candy bars or like a drink, like a soda can or something.
I would love to see a Paloma candy bar or snack or drink. Sign me up. Hopefully it happens. Are there any other like new mediums you'd like to explore? I know in your YouTube videos, you do a lot of like tactile creations. Like what else is out there for you? What are you thinking about?
So once I finish this semester, I am thinking about doing ceramic classes at a studio here in Houston. Because when I took my ceramics class in college, it was during the pandemic. So I never got to learn how to use a potter's wheel, which really sucked. So I'm thinking about taking classes and then, you know, hopefully using that studio's kiln and wheel and maybe one day selling my own ceramic stuff.
Yes, I see it for you. I'm hoping for it. Thank you so much, Paloma, for letting me ask you all of these questions. Can you tell me like how people can support you, what your upcoming launches are, or any upcoming things that you have going on so that we can all show up and support you?
Thank you. So for November, I am collaborating with Mini Gallery Box, which is a subscription service where our artists will collab with the company. And basically we create 3 prints, 3 stickers, and you pay the price and they get sent to you. It's going to be super fun. I'm going to try to do a theme that is very true to me. I'm going for like cowboy witch vibes. So yeah, that's what's coming up.
Awesome. Thanks so much for sharing with us. I can't wait to see all of it. The prints, the stickers, everything. I wish you the best at the market and through the holiday season, because I imagine you'll be doing holiday launches. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, for sharing everything that you shared. I really mean it. And yeah, thank you.
Thank you for having me. It was so fun.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, everyone, thanks for listening to this chat with the incredible Paloma Cordova. If you want to see more of her work or watch her incredible YouTube videos, head to Paloma the Peach. I'm going to leave all her info in the show notes so you can check it out. I really encourage you to, because it's just like such a delight to watch her videos, to see her artwork. It's just the best. And just a little reminder, listeners of the podcast can get a free undated weekly and monthly planner inspired by the show by using the link in our show notes or going to drawsinspanish.com. And since we talked so much about YouTube in this episode, I just wanted to mention that I have a YouTube channel. It's at Fabiolita Draws, same as my Instagram handle. I'll leave it linked in the show notes. But if you want to see videos from me between podcast episodes, you can go subscribe to my channel and hear more from me there. Finally, if there's a Latinx visual artist based in the US that you think we should speak to on the show, go ahead and nominate them by going to drawsinspanish.com/nominate. Now, remember to hit subscribe so you don't miss the next episode of Draws in Spanish. Thank you and hasta la próxima. Ciao, ciao.